From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Happy New Year to you. Today's show is a very special one. To kick off 2016, I've put together a show of my favorite segments from the past year. And I thought I'd start with a man who's not just one of my favorite interviews of the year, but one of my favorites of all time, Salman Rushdie. Rushdie has written 12 novels. His latest is 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, and it was released last year. He was in Georgia in September, and he was reading from the book at the Jimmy Carter Library and Museum. I started by asking him what had inspired this book about human fear.
No, I started writing it, I guess, over 3 years ago. And in fact, I just worked out the other day, which slightly spooked me, that the length of time it took to write was about exactly the length of time in the title.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, somebody asked me, how long did you spend writing this book? And so I thought, well, let me work that out. And I thought, yeah, it was 2 years and 8 months and 3 weeks or so. Oh, my goodness. You know, it's exactly the same length of time that is described in the title. So there's something very odd about that.
Well, that's 1,001 nights. And that wasn't my other question, was whether you decided you were going to write a book that featured the jinn in it, or you decided you were going to write a book about the 1,001 Arabian Nights. Which came first?
Well, in terms of storytelling, I wanted to write something which was very fantasticated. You know, I mean, the book before this was the opposite of this. The book before this was a
memoir.
Was a memoir, and I'd spent the previous, you know, those three years, trying as hard as I could not to have anything made up, you know, to try and tell the truth. And then I thought, I want to get back to what I really like most, which is making up stories, and let me go to the other end of the spectrum, and started making up something very, very extreme. And yes, it comes out of my, you know, it comes out of my childhood, really, which is when I first encountered all these wonderful tales, which, you know, of which the Arabian Nights is just the most famous compendium, but not the only one. And I thought, let me try and tell a story like that, but set in mostly in New York. I mean, it's as if I arrived in New York with all these stories in my baggage. And I thought, let me see what happens if I unpack the bags and, you know, kind of throw these genies at Manhattan.
You know, you actually kind of almost warn readers about the dangers of fiction. I want to read a little piece from it. You say, the thing I'm thinking is that all these stories are fiction, she said, even the ones that insist on being facts, like who was where first and whose God had precedence over whose. They're all make-believe fantasies. The realist fantasies and the fantastic fantasies are both made up. And the first thing to know about made-up stories is that they're all untrue in the same way. Is that a warning about how to read your novels?
Well, I think one of the great things about growing up in this world of fairy tale and fable is that it teaches you very early in your life that fiction is fictional. You know, that the illusion that fiction is real, which realist novelists try and foist on us, you know, is just another kind of illusion. And once you have that in your mind, it kind of sets you free. Then carpets can start flying, you know. And actually, I think there actually is a flying carpet or two in this book.
There is, although she complains about it. And and I mean, I think this is one of the things, and I made a mistake by reading a bunch of reviews before I actually read the book. But the thing that I miss all the time is that people don't talk about how funny your books are. I mean, they're really funny, and there's a lot of jokes, like out-and-out jokes. I wonder if you're ever sitting there thinking, oh, I better take this joke out because I'm literature with a capital L.
No, I really have no sense of being literature with a capital L. I mean, I prefer to just write. I mean, I like books that are funny. You know, I mean, to speak as a reader, I have some difficulty with even the greatest books if they are completely lacking in a sense of humor. And, you know, I'm looking at you, George Eliot. I have had in my life some real trouble with Middlemarch.
I enjoyed it, but it is a slog.
Yeah, there's no gags in Middlemarch, you know.
There aren't, and there's a lot of gags. And I mean, I love the part where you describe now Mr. Geronimo, which ironically you point out that he has to say that he's India from India instead of Indian Native American, and yet you've named him after the great Apache chief. But he starts floating above the ground, and then you describe him as a down-to-earth man.
Well, that's what I think. That's the kind of comedy of him. Yes, and talking about the two kinds of Indian, you know, I think we have to sometimes agree to use the formulation of dot, not feather, you know. and he gets named after Feather, not Dot, so that's his one of his problems. It's not his biggest problem. His biggest problem is coming unstuck from the earth. And I thought the fact that he's a gardener, you know, he's somebody who's dedicated his life to the care of the earth, to nurturing the soil and things that grow out of it, and that for that person to suddenly see that his feet don't touch the ground anymore is first of all, it's funny, but it also it's poignant, I hope. You know, it gives him a real problem, but it also gives him that double thing of being both a comic figure and a tragic figure.
The thing is, though, that within all that comedy, and it is through the entire book, I think that's one of the things I really enjoy about your writing, is there really is this sort of serious thread in there. And I loved what Ursula K. Le Guin said about you. She said, Rushdie is a generous, good-natured writer who'd rather woo and seduce his readers than reduce the truth to gall and brimstone and make them swallow it.
Ursula Le Guin, I have to say, has been hanging in there for me from the very, very beginning. I mean, from my very first novel, Grimus, which was published 40 years ago, she wrote kind of the most generous review of that book, and here she is again. I mean, I think I owe her quite a bit.
And there is behind all this irony, although you put it in a way that is easy to read. I want to read this other passage. You say, all these crazy things are going on in New York, as you say, these incredible storms, a sea monster rises up out of the water and swallows a ferry boat with all the passengers on it. And one of the characters is upset by this, and you write, she was familiar with a certain type of American crazy. Gun crazy was normal to her, shooting at kids at school, or putting on a Joker mask and mowing people down in a mall, or just plain murdering your mom at breakfast crazy, Second Amendment crazy. That was just the everyday crazy that kept going down, and there was nothing you could do about it if you loved freedom. And there, to me, it feels like the crux of the book. And I wonder how you went about trying to deliver this message about what is crazy and what is normal in a readable way.
I mean, that is, you know, that is somewhere near the heart of the book, because what I thought is that the world is crazy right now. You know, that all kinds of bizarre and not just violent, but including violent things happen every day. And I think many people have that sense of the world having changed very, very fast and continuing to change very, very fast and having become a strange place. A lot of people, I think, feel a little bewildered and alienated by the rate of change. And I thought, well, let me take that feeling that genuinely exists, I think, and see how I can make a story about it, which in a way encapsulates or turns into fairy tale, that true feeling.
And you use I found it interesting you use the word supranormal and not supernatural. Why?
Well, because supernatural is creatures in white sheets, you know. Supernatural is Ghostbusters. I mean, even though there actually is a reference to Ghostbusters.
There is.
But I think supernatural people associate with, you know, ghosts, spooks. And this is something else. This is suggesting just that what we think of as normal ain't normal anymore. You know, the world has become such a bizarre place that there are these other levels which feel almost surrealist, except they're really happening. Whether we're talking about technological revolution or war or fanaticism or the various kinds of crazy that were in that passage that you read.
And speaking of fanaticism, which is kind of another really deep theme in the book, at one point you have the philosopher Ibn Rushd say, you will see as time goes by that in the end it will be religion that will make men turn away from God. The godly are God's worst advocates. It may take 1,001 years, but in the end religion will shrivel away and only then will we begin to live in God's truth. So is this book anti-religion?
Well, I mean, it's against certainly a number of things done in the name of religion, you know, all of which we can see on the news every day. But what it suggests, and it's something that I've often thought, is that religion might be something that people outgrow. You know, I think that, interestingly, many of the old polytheistic religions contain that idea. You know, in the old Greek and Roman myths, there actually is a moment that comes when the Greek and Roman gods, who have previously been interfering on an almost daily basis in human life, taking sides in the Trojan War and so on, but there's a moment when they simply withdraw. They go back to Olympus and they leave the human race to its own devices. There's a similar moment in the Norse mythology where the gods actually have to engage in the battle, which is normally known as the Twilight of the Gods, in which they battle and destroy their adversaries but are also destroyed by them. And after that, the human race has to live in a world in which the gods are no longer there. So this is an idea that's quite an old idea, that human beings, the human race at some point outgrows the gods or the gods withdraw, and then we're just left to ourselves. And I think, you know, I think there's something good about that. I like that idea.
You know, and yet for all of your intellect, which no one's going to argue with, your books reveal you to be such a softy. And I mean, what saves the world in this book is love. One of the djinn learns how to love. And one of the things I love in this book is that listening is actually magic.
Yes. You listen, and women, by the way, very good at it. It's the female djinn in the novel who is a mistress of the art of listening, where she can put her ear to your chest and know exactly your heart's desire, you know exactly what's going on inside you. I think writers have to be good listeners, you know. I think one of the things you have to be able to do as a writer is hear what people are really saying, you know, and be able to represent that. So yes, listening is great magic. It's softy magic, maybe.
So I'm in Atlanta right now. I found one mention of Georgia in your book. I'm going to read it here. You say,
yeah, it's in there.
Yeah, when an ice storm hit Georgia, people abandoned their cars on the interstate and fled as if pursued by a gigantic ice monster. Which leads me to ask, were you here in January of last year?
No, I wasn't, but I was there very soon. I was there very soon after, and everybody told me about it.
So, so a little bit of truth there. You know, it's kind of surreal. I have to imagine it's surreal to be a quote-unquote celebrity author.
I mean, people say that, but actually in my daily life, it doesn't really impinge very much. You know, I mean, a writer's life, it requires you to be alone in a room a great deal of the time. Otherwise, the books don't get written. And also the books themselves, you know, writing is very hard to do, and it keeps you honest. You know, you can't really have a very inflated idea of yourself when every day you're facing the limits of your own talent. You know, so I mean, yes, it gets me seats at Yankee games and tables at restaurants, but that's about it.
That was a portion of my interview with author Salman Rushdie. He was in Atlanta in September. This is On Second Thought. We continue with some of my favorite stories of the year. We have a series on this show called Break It Down. It's where we take a phrase or a term that's being used in headlines, and then we explain it in the simplest possible terms. I love this series, not least because I always learn a lot when I'm writing them. I want to play one of the segments that just floored me. I was stunned by a lot of the information I uncovered in the research for this. It was a segment on civil forfeiture. Civil forfeiture is actually pretty common, but it is not well understood. And so we break it down. Break it down, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Break it down now. Break it down. Civil forfeiture is seizure of property by a government agency, usually law enforcement. It's been used since the American Revolution, and it actually helped spark the war. The British were irritated by rampant smuggling in the colonies, so they started issuing writs of assistance. As long as officials had a stated reason, they could enter someone's home or business, search anywhere they pleased, take anything they wanted, and then not worry about the damage they inflicted. Not surprisingly, the colonists weren't happy with the situation, and just like a teenager, the king had only one thing to say. I don't care. I love it. I love it. I don't care. in the Bill of Rights, you see explicit language. It's in the Fourth Amendment, protecting Americans from unreasonable searches and seizures. So, for example, a police officer can't search your vehicle without probable cause. Sometimes it's clear there's good reason, like in this scene from the movie Liar Liar.
You know why I pulled you over?
Depends on how long you were following me. Eesh.
Why don't we just take it from the top?
Here goes. I sped. I followed too closely. I ran a stop sign. I almost hit a Chevy. I sped some more. I failed to yield at a crosswalk. I changed lanes in the intersection. I changed lanes without signaling while running a red light and speeding!
But sometimes probable cause is a lot murkier. When the Bill of Rights was being written, the American government was plagued with piracy along its coasts and on the bounding main. And pirates were hard to deal with.
It is my intention to commandeer one of these ships, pick up a crew and Tortuga, raid, pillage, plunder, and otherwise pilfer my Weasley black guts out.
Pirates were often just the hired help. The ship's owner could be thousands of miles away, sipping Beaujolais in France and hunting grouse in the Highlands. So Congress decreed officials could seize a boat and its contents without filing criminal charges against the owner. Forfeiture laws had rarely been used since the day of the pirates, except during the Civil War and Prohibition. That's when police officers would regularly grab vehicles carrying hooch. Then came the war on drugs in the 1980s, and civil forfeiture came back with a vengeance. Here's George H.W. Bush.
And to those who say that drugs should be legalized, I say that legalization is just another word for surrender. And surrender is not in our vocabulary.
So what had changed since the day of the pirates? Using the law to take property from often innocent civilians. Let's pause for clarification here. There are two kinds of forfeiture. When someone is found guilty by a judge or jury of a crime, the government can seize anything that was used in committing that crime or was bought with illegally earned money. Think the drug dealer's Corvette or the money launderer's yacht. Civil forfeiture cases are very different. You'll often see cases called State of Texas versus Diamond Necklace or State of Georgia versus Dodge Durango. Property doesn't have rights like a human being, so actions against property can be taken on the basis of mere suspicion or probable cause with no need to prove a crime. So that's civil forfeiture at its most basic. The government taking stuff or money from one of its citizens without proving that citizen has done anything wrong. Now you get it. And now let's bring in our guest. Scott Bullock is senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. He's taken a close look at civil forfeiture laws across the U.S. and here in Georgia. He joins us from D.C. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And first, I have to ask you, did we get anything wrong in there?
No, not at all. It was great encapsulation of the history of civil forfeiture, and I think it showed how far civil forfeiture has strayed from its narrow historical origins, at least in the U.S., where it was used essentially to enforce custom laws and for piracy laws. And it wasn't really until the past 30 years that it took off, and we see where we are today, where it is a system that generates millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars at the federal level, and hundreds of millions of dollars at the state and local level for law enforcement.
And when you say that it generates money for law enforcement, how exactly does that work? Is it as simple as somebody, a police officer, pulling you over and being allowed to take whatever's in your car?
Well, it sometimes can be that simple, and that's one of the many outrages about civil forfeiture, is the ability to seize property. And because it's a civil proceeding, the burden is very light on the government. They essentially just have to show by preponderance of the evidence, more than 50%, that the property is somehow connected to illegal activity. And they'll say, well, I suspect that you're a drug dealer or you're laundering money. That's why you have, you know, $2,000 or $5,000 in cash on you. And under civil forfeiture laws in Georgia and in most states and at the federal level, the burden then switches to the property owner to prove his innocence. And that is exactly the opposite of the fundamental American notion that everybody is innocent until proven guilty, and that the government has to prove that you are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
And some of the money that has been seized and property has been used to give police employees bonuses or throw parties.
One of the most fundamental reforms that should happen to civil forfeiture, in addition to just simply abolishing it, is to change this profit incentive. It should go back to the way it was before the laws were changed in the 1980s, so that if we're going to have civil forfeiture, the money should go to the general fund of the state, or it should go to some neutral fund like education or drug treatment to remove these perverse financial incentives.
We're talking with Scott Bullock. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and we're talking about civil forfeiture. Scott, let me just give you one hypothetical and just tell me if it's actually feasible that this would happen. Let's say I'm going to buy a car. I have $10,000 in my car to pay cash for the vehicle. I get pulled over on a routine traffic stop. The officer says, why would you have $10,000 in cash if you weren't dealing in drugs? I'm going to seize that. Is that a possible thing that I would just lose that $10,000 for that reason?
Sure. They could seize it right there. They'll say, you know, we don't believe you. They could possibly have a drug dog come out, do a sniff on it. They'll get a hit for drugs on the currency. And so much of currency in the U.S. has some degree of drug residue on it. And then they'll seize it from you. And then all the burdens are on you to try to get your property back.
Georgia allegedly has some of the worst or most extreme, I should say, civil forfeiture laws in the country. Can you give me an example of a case that's arisen in Georgia that might help people get a grasp on this concept?
Well, it depends on what you want to talk about. I mean, there's cases where property owners have had their cash seized with no charges filed. You have the situation where the police officer in Georgia received a $90,000 Dodge Viper for supposed use by the law enforcement agency, but it was something that police officers and the chief himself not surprisingly, like to drive around. But Georgia has this really trifecta of circumstances that make their laws so bad. The government has a very light burden on it. Again, in some instances, just to show probable cause that the property is somehow connected to illegal activity. The burden is then on the property owner to try to prove his or her innocence rather than the government to prove guilt. And then the final thing is that in Georgia, 100% of the proceeds go back to law enforcement. Some states you see a 60-40 split or a 50-50 split, but Georgia 100% goes directly back to law enforcement.
So we've talked about some legal terms, preponderance of evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt. I should mention that in only two states, that's Nebraska and Wisconsin, does civil forfeiture actually require that standard beyond a reasonable doubt? Is that why it's so difficult for people to get their money or their cars back?
Yeah, it's one of the many reasons why it's very difficult to do so. Also in civil forfeiture, because it's a civil proceeding, you have no right to an attorney if you happen not to be able to afford one. That's, again, something that everybody knows and from watching television, that you have the right to an attorney if you can't afford one. Every criminal suspect is told that. Civil forfeiture, it's a civil proceeding. So you do not have the right to an attorney, and property owners have to go out and hire an attorney to try to get their property back. So it's a huge advantage that the government has, where if they're seizing, you know, maybe an older car or $3,000 or $5,000, lawyers can burn through that pretty quickly. And so the cost of fighting this oftentimes exceeds the value of the property. If property owners don't have the wherewithal to fight, or they don't have the financial resources to fight, they will just throw in the towel and the government can win by default.
Scott Bullock is senior attorney with the Institute for Justice. You can find that entire Break It Down series at our page on SoundCloud. You know, there's been so much great music on the show in the past year. That's because Georgia is full to bursting with incredible talent in all genres of music. I have a soft spot in my heart for classical music, of course. So I wanted to bring back the voice of Jamie Barton. I interviewed Jamie, but she also gave us two picks for our Georgia playlist. The playlist includes songs by Georgia musicians that really express the feel of the state, and these are the picks from Jamie Barton.
My name is Jamie Barton. I'm an opera singer, and I live in Cabbage Town, Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a mezzo-soprano. The first song I would like to talk about is Sleep With One Eye Open by Michael Daves and Chris Thiele. Michael is, well, he's originally from Atlanta, Georgia. He now lives up in Brooklyn, where half of the bluegrass world lives right now. It's more of the music that is really a part of what I love about this song. The lyrics, in a way, are kind of, you know, inconsequential. I've heard Chris Thiele actually talk about that. He comes up with the music first and then fits lyrics around it. And I can see that being the case in this particular song. My love for music started in bluegrass and classic rock. And I still love bluegrass. I think it's an incredibly virtuosic, very malleable kind of genre. You can see that malleability with the progressive bluegrass that's going on now. And just if you listen to a banjo player, if you listen to Chris Thiele playing the mandolin or Michael Daves playing the guitar, you hear something that is extraordinary when it comes to the technique. I honestly think that minus the instrumentation and the difference in the genres, we're actually, opera is, classical music in general is actually fairly tied to what they're doing. The second song that I have chosen is Du bist die Ruhe, being sung by a phenomenal opera treasure of Georgia, Roland Hayes, who, as it turns out, was born less than 10 miles from where I grew up. And I think there might be something to the phrase, there's something in the water. This one in particular, I think, is really beautiful. It's an art song, a very famous one that I haven't actually sung yet, but it's just so beautifully sung. It sounds like a lullaby, and he does it just so sweetly. It's phenomenal, really. He was singing at the turn of the of 1900s. He was one of the pioneers as an American artist in general, but as a Black American artist, he made amazing headway. There's this incredible story of him in Germany standing up to sing, and the crowd's absolutely trying to shout him down, and he just stood there and waited until they got it out of their system, and then he started singing, and they gave him a standing ovation because it was so beautiful. But they had never had a Black artist in their midst, and they didn't know how to handle it. And so he was an ambassador not only for this art, but for diversity. I think there is a Georgia sound, but I also think that it encompasses so many different areas. You have this earthiness, I think, to the artistry that I hear out of Georgia artists. It doesn't matter if you're talking about Roland Hayes, Michael Daves, the B-52s, or whoever else. You have this truthful, of-the-earth kind of sound and artistry that comes up. And I think people respond to that everywhere. And I think we have that in spades with Georgia.
Mezzo-soprano Jamie Barton shared her picks for our Georgia Playlist series. You can find that whole series at our SoundCloud page. And if you want to add a song of your own, you can tweet us at OST Talk or call us at 404-500-9457 and then leave a message.
Life's like the road that you travel on. There's one day here and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand. Sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. Where the brave are free, lovers soar.
We talk about traffic a lot on this show, so it may not be surprising that one of my favorite segments of the year dealt with travel by car. This summer, we decided to find out which navigation system actually helps you get through traffic the best. So all five of us left our studio just off I-85, and we headed to a place called the Brake Pad in College Park. We all left at the same time during a rainy evening rush hour. I used my Garmin GPS unit, Linda Chen used the Waze app, Sean Powers took Apple Maps with him, and Jessica Metzger went old school and printed out MapQuest directions. Finally, Lindsay Foster Thomas used her local street smarts that she acquired as a native of the city. So who would win the great GPS race of 2014? For all of us, the mission seemed impossible.
Radio tune to 88.5. All right. Get going.
Turn left on Northside Drive Northwest.
And we're off. In the race, I'm gonna lose.
I'm an Atlanta native, and I know these streets better than any GPS or navigation device. I'll be arriving first at the Brake Pad.
Turn on my Waze. Okay, so my trip is 26 minutes and within 10 miles, right in the thick of Atlanta traffic.
I would have automatically been lost already because this direction made it sound like I should take a left out of our building when I needed to take a right. So already MapQuest failed.
3/4 of a mile, turn right on a north side drive, northwest. Yeehaw! Whoa, just saw a near car accident.
Good Lord. I suppose if you have a truck, you don't care if you cause an accident?
Keep left and then turn
to left.
Alright, after this red car, I'm getting in there.
In there, yeah! Merge!
So, should be smooth sailing from here on out. There's usually no traffic troubles going down this street. It's an underutilized thoroughfare, but as you can see, it's a little bit of a rough road. Whoa. Potholes everywhere.
Keep left on East Point Street.
But there's utility work up ahead. GPS. Did that figure into your calculations? Also, did you calculate that there would be a police officer right there staring at me? Oh, look, there's a farmer's market.
Here's some music from outside.
Oh my God, Sean Powers is right next to me. It's down to the wire now. He doesn't see me, which is good because I'm about to smoke him. All right, Prius, it's your time to shine.
Is that Lindsay ahead? Hey, Lindsay! She was like way ahead of me. How is this possible? I just want to go. I just want to go. I just want to go.
Let me in, truck. Ah, you suck. Let me in. Okay. Oh, dang it. Thank you.
I missed a few turns. That was, part of it was computer error. Some of it was human error. Most of it was human error. But I'm getting there. I'm almost still alive. And that's always a good sign. And so we'll see what happens.
Oh, well, this is the record.
You have reached your destination.
Awesome.
Oh, I see Lindsay. Is she first?
We made it. Back streets. I think we're the winner.
At address 3403 on right.
Okay, I'm here.
Thank you, GPS. Yes, you can turn off.
Final results. I surprised myself by coming in first with my Garmin just barely beating Lindsay Backroads Thomas by 1 minute. Jessica came in third with MapQuest, although, honestly, she may have cheated. She left a little bit early. Linda came in fourth with Waze, and Sean and his Apple Maps, they came in last. Remember, these results are completely unscientific, but we had a good time testing them out. You can try a GPS race with your friends, and then be sure to tell us about it and share your commuter stories at 404-500-9457. You know, some of the best interviews I do are the ones that surprise me. I love to be surprised. And my interview with actor Bill Oberst was a real eye-opener for me. Bill does a one-man show called Louis Grizzard in His Own Words. He's played Grizzard more than 1,000 times. I had never heard of Louis Grizzard, but he was a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and a stand-up comic. He was a beloved voice on what it meant to be a Southerner, and it's a voice that we lost in 1994 when he died at the age of 47. Actor Bill Oberst has his voice down pat.
Yankees think we talk funny. God talks like we do. And man, you ought to hear Southern crowds go crazy. They love this stuff. He feeds them the red meat, which says the South is an exceptional place. That's what makes Grizzard, Grizzard.
And to a certain extent, you can make the same argument about any region, right? Every region's exceptional.
Of course you can.
But he pointed out what was unique about the South.
Grizzard said that the small town roots of most Southerners of his generation, late 20th century, that small town Southern culture gave something to people that without which America would be the poorer, that was an essential part of the American fabric, the small town Southern life with all of its flaws and all of its many problems, that style of life was important to the overall fabric of America. He believed it vehemently and unapologetically.
And he hated that term New South.
Hated it.
Why?
Because to him, the South was the South. He was very, very anti-Yankee. And the reason he was anti-Yankee was because Grizzard was big in the era when we had the Yankee influx. And people from other areas coming in and saying, here's how we did it back home. And so Grizzard famously said, I don't care how you did it in Cleveland. If you don't like it here, Delta's ready when you are, I guarantee you.
And he actually lived in Chicago for a while and was miserable. By all reports, miserable.
He said they had two seasons. They got two seasons in Chicago, 4th of July and wintertime. That's all they got. The only good thing to come out of Chicago is I-65 South, baby.
Going back, and he wrote a book about how unhappy he was, saying basically, when I get back to Georgia, I'm going to nail my feet to the ground.
His book titles, Celeste, are just great. One of them called Don't Bend Over in the Garden, Granny, You Know Them Taters Got Eyes. So he was playing into the Southern stereotype, but he did it with intelligence, with subtlety, with nuance. And like Mark Twain, his own flaws and foibles were right out there, and that's why people loved him.
Now, you're from Los Angeles.
No, I am from South Carolina, and I did theater in New York up and down the East Coast 15 years, including this Grizzard show, and I've been out in L.A. for the last 6 years playing mostly killers on television and movies.
Interesting. But what fascinates, and we're going to talk about that at some later date, but let's talk about your fascination with Grizzard.
What?
Because you've played him hundreds and hundreds of times. Why do you not get sick of this guy?
Over 1,000 times. You can't get sick of someone who's loved. Grizzard is the uncle who comes to Thanksgiving dinner who you know will probably say something improper, but you really, really like the guy. And I feel from audiences every time that I come out on stage in Grizzard's own glasses, through which I can't see a damn thing, and his own Gucci loafers. When I come out on stage...
His widow gave you his khakis as well, right?
Yes, I wear his clothes and his glasses. And when I look out at the audience, I feel love and I feel affection. Unbridled affection from a whole generation of people who were very saddened that their way of life just went away as the 21st century came in. And everything changed. And people no longer know their neighbors. And they no longer sit on the porch. And they no longer start sentences with, well, let me tell you. Because nobody has the time to do that anymore. We all have to be so quick and so rushed. And people are sad that went away. And those are my people. That's who comes to the show. They come from the country, Celeste. You know, I generally don't get city people. I get people from way out in the country who will drive an hour and a half. And they'll wear their Sunday clothes and they'll come to see their friend.
And yet he was voted the author from hell at a publishing convention because of the way he behaves on book tours.
He could be difficult, yes.
How do you handle that in your your one-man show?
Without warts.
Warts and all.
Warts and all, yeah. The first act is stand-up comedy in which he tells his great stories and jokes, and the second act is readings from his books and columns where he reveals a little more about himself. And as he famously said, you know, he almost died a couple times. It was very public, and people would pray for him and bring him back and until he finally passed. But he said once, he said, "I don't know why my Methodist Lord has extended my life. I ain't been the best person. Although I have not violated all of the Ten Commandments, I ain't ever made no graven image." So he would present his flaws and then make a joke out of it. So he had that ability that people of that generation had to make you laugh and cry, but you have to take your time with them. You can't rush them. So when someone from the internet age, raised in the internet age, comes to the stage, I see them going crazy at my show when their parents make them come because they're thinking, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? It's like, shh, just sit there, child. Just sit there and let me tell you a story. And that's of another generation.
That was actor Bill Oberst Jr. He performed his one-man show on Louis Grizzard in Stone Mountain last January. Now on to my final favorites pick. And I want to stay with this theme of things that surprise me. In this case, it was a little-known fact about historically black colleges. They were once a refuge for Jewish scholars. HBCUs would hire Jewish refugees when other schools would not. And that little slice of history inspired a new novel from political journalist Peter Golden. It's called Wherever There Is Light. I spoke to Peter in November.
This starts with what was called the Negro Press at the time. In the 30s, while a lot of people were debating what Hitler was really up to, the Negro Press was a lot more interested in his ideology. This was during the time when they were trying to get President Roosevelt to support anti-lynching legislation. And these African-American journalists and African-Americans in general understood the connection between ideology and violence. Most of the world was talking about what Hitler was doing, grabbing land, rebuilding his armed forces. They spoke about his ideology and the danger of that ideology because, of course, they had suffered from it because of this rash of lynchings. So the starting point is both what was going on in the press and these colleges. And I think it was really a way for my two characters to meet, for Julian Rose and for Kendall Wakefield to meet. But I wanted people to know about it because it's so unknown. And they rescued that I know of 300 or so that I know of. There may have been more. They also brought white professors onto campus at a time when segregation was so horrible. They didn't bury white people and black people in the same cemeteries. So that was really the starting point of the book, was this idea.
So just so people who, most people have not read the book yet, but Julian is a Jewish refugee immigrant, and he is a former gangster.
Yes, he was a bootlegger who made a fortune in the bootlegging business.
And now is an entrepreneur, real estate magnate sort of kind of guy.
And he goes down and he meets the founder of the college's granddaughter. Her name is Kendall Wakefield.
It's a fictional college.
Yes, it's called Lovewood College. It's fictional. The college is built on the plantation where her grandfather had once been a slave. The other part of the book that I was fascinated with was the idea that there were so many of these very wealthy African-American families that no one talks about. And so he was one of these families, the Wakefield family.
And this is an interesting point, is you're kind of delving into a history of African-Americans that, as you say, is not examined or written about all that often. And that's the more intellectual upper class African-American. And in this case, Julian goes down and he falls in love with the black daughter of the president of this university. And this African-American woman who runs this college is not happy that she's
Garland. She's very unhappy. And she has all the sort of feelings that an upper class woman would have when she sees her daughter, who she always thought would manage their fortune and the college, falling in love with someone she thinks is just a straight-up gangster. And he is. So she's not wrong about that.
I don't want we're going to go delve into more history, but I don't want people to think that this is a history book. This is a novel, and it's at its heart a love story.
Yes, it's about Julian and Kendall's relationship beginning in the late 1930s all the way to the mid-1960s. And it takes place in South Florida and in Greenwich Village and in post-war Paris. Both Kendall and Julian are involved in the war. He in the Office of Strategic Services, which is a forerunner of the CIA, and she becomes a very well-known combat photographer.
And you know, you're dealing with some really layer upon layer of what could be very tricky racial issues. There's a lynching in the book. There is a number of offensive interactions and awkward relationships. And I wonder how you approach that, especially in our current society when it's very easy to give offense and very easy to turn people off. How did you handle?
History is history. And like it or not, we're stuck with it. My feeling was that history is most interesting in its grays. The political world runs on blacks and whites in the sense, and I'm not talking about race here, I'm talking about extremes. And you see this in the debates, you see this in our current atmosphere. History, which is the current moment plus time, is all different shades of gray. And unless you're willing to explore that and be reasonable about what you find and be accurate about what you find, then I don't see why one would bother writing history. The fact is, here's the fact. The most lynchings in the United States happened in Florida, like it or not.
So another thing that your book kind of addresses sort of on the periphery of this love story is this sort of, for many people, what they felt was an inherent comradeship between Jews of that time and African Americans, that these were two populations that at some level understood one another. How did you go about, I guess, researching that?
Well, it was pretty easy in Florida because there used to be signs up in hotels, no Jews, no Negroes, no dogs allowed. So it was really pretty easy.
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty easy to see where their commonality was. Also, Jews at that time didn't enjoy the same social position that they have now in America. So they were just here as immigrants. This was the first wave of Eastern Europeans. And a lot of them were drawn into entertainment. And of course, there was an enormous togetherness in terms of comedians, music, and this whole cauldron in New York City was comprised mainly of Jews and African Americans. And they were jazz aficionados. There was, of course, Benny Goodman had Lionel Hampton in his band. They were early involved in these kinds of things. So there was kind of a natural symmetry. Also, once after the Great Migration, there were all of these African-Americans in cities where Jews lived. Harlem was Jewish before it was African-American.
Peter Golden is the author of the novel Wherever There Is Light. And that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed some of my favorite segments. If you have your own, I'd love to hear about them. Or tell me what you hope to hear on the show in 2016. Call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSTTalk or facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Happy New Year.